This is Adam Fenderson from the website energybulletin.net, interviewing David Holmgren, co-originator of the permaculture concept. The interview took place in April 2004 at David's permaculture showcase farm in rural Victoria, Australia, called Meliodora. The interview was first on the website globalpublicmedia.org as a video, and there's a transcript at energybulletin.net. We're talking about the issue of peak oil and permaculture's role in a world of energy descent. David's written a book about this stuff, which you can get at his website, holmgren.com.au.
Could you please give us your definition of permaculture and tell us a little bit about your role in its creation and evolution?
Well, permaculture is a design system for sustainable living and land use in the sort of simplest terms. It came out of awareness about the limits of resources and especially the energy crises of the 1970s. Work between myself and Bill Mollison when I was a student in environmental design in Tasmania. Since then, permaculture has spread around the world as a grassroots movement of activists and designers, teachers, land managers, both gardeners and farmers, but also it's connected into a very broad church of sustainable alternatives in sustainable building and alternative currency ideas, eco-villages, many diverse areas. So it started from the premise of looking at the redesign of agriculture using ecological principles, but it extended out from that to the redesign of the whole of society using ecological principles. I suppose the foundation text was Permaculture One, which was published in 1978. Which was joint work between myself and Bill Mollison. And then the biggest sort of development of permaculture applications was really Bill Mollison's Designer's Manual, mm-hmm. which was published in 1988. And then more recently, my new book, Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, has taken those ideas to a broader frame of reference, away from just talking about maybe land management and practical issues, to dealing with the fundamental underlying principles behind permaculture and the link to resource limits and especially energy peak.
So what exactly is energy peak, or what do you mean when you employ that phrase?
Well, I suppose my understanding of that comes from both an awareness of the ideas of limits to non-renewable resources and the early predictions on some of those, especially the Club of Rome Limits to Growth Report in 1972, which in a way has gone down in the public intellectual mythology as being failed, you know, that they got it wrong. In fact, it was sort of remarkably on track. But more recently, the work of Colin Campbell and the other retired independent oil geologists identifying the fact that the numbers behind oil, arguably the most important set of numbers in the world, was in fact largely garbage. And the emergence of that information in the mid-90s, and then the gradual debate and discussion around that, identifying this very important characteristic that once you've halfway through a resource, the decline in the availability means that's the most critical point, not when you run out at some stage in the future. So the critical peak that we're reaching now, I understand, is in relation to what's called conventional oil, and then further peaks to come in world gas supplies that are the really important ones. But we can think of it as generally an energy peak, a cluster of different resources that peak and then decline, all in the next few decades.
So did this awareness of the energy peak leave the permaculture movement for a while?
Well, if you look at permaculture emerged out of that, what I call the first wave of modern environmental awareness in the 1970s, that this huge upwelling of positive creative responses to energy constraint in the late 70s. And then that appeared to go away. Now there's a whole lot of factors that explain that. And food prices became the cheapest they've been in human history. A lot of the incentives for why we would focus on food self-sufficiency and a lot of the other permaculture strategies actually sort of weakened. So, for example, the development of the city farms and community gardens movement in Australia, which in a lot of ways has been an outcome of the permaculture movement, has focused a lot on the social benefits of people growing food in the cities rather than the food security issues. So there's been a lot of ways in which people have had to adapt to the fact that a lot of these permaculture ideas, at least in the Western world, in the affluent world, there wasn't really good, hard economic or obvious practical reasons why you really needed to do this. And so over 20 years or so, that meant people adapted these ideas to the social realities and economic realities that they found themselves in. And that, of course, becomes habitual over a lifetime. And so I've been sort of drawing the links back, because some of the accumulated wisdom of the last 25 years or so of permaculture activism doesn't necessarily apply when you really move into an energy descent world. And a lot of the experience of permaculture activism in third world countries actually makes a lot of sense. That's the other thing to realise, that permaculture is spread around the world and is already dealing with energy descent type situations in other countries. And one of the places, for example, where people interested in permaculture go to study that as much as to help is Cuba, where you've got a society that was actually a quite industrialised agricultural society that went into, if you like, an artificial energy descent because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that they've actually adapted to that in quite a creative way. Drawing those links in the permaculture movement to say these are general lessons that will need to be applied everywhere rather than just third world versus first world type situations.
So you expect those third world situations to apply to us in the near future?
Yeah, in a broad sense. It's interesting that Mollison's off-the-cuff comment in the Global Gardener television program, which was produced in 1989, had him traipsing around the world to various permaculture projects. And he said, we need to get these competent gardeners from the third world to rich countries to teach people how to grow food, reversing that whole idea of aid. And effectively, that is part of what's needed, conceptually at least, if not literally.
What about the broader environmental movement? Do you have a problem getting the awareness of limits to growth back into that arena?
Well, I think it's very interesting that a lot of the environmental activism that is current, is based on a foundation. Its bedrock foundation is really in the limits of climate and the greenhouse effect and excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, what's interesting about the energy peak arguments is that they are the insight of the first wave of environmentalism of the late 70s coming back to the fore, but folding in and combining with the insight from the second wave of environmental awareness, which was from the late 80s, which is all greenhouse driven. Because it was really, although the idea was well back there, I can remember discussing with Mollison in the mid-1970s, the greenhouse effect, and speculating about its impacts. But it wasn't really until the mid-1980s that the gathering consensus about the reality of greenhouse started to drive the environmental agenda. Now, I think broadly, the same sorts of strategies make sense, whether you're looking at it from a greenhouse agenda or from an energy peak agenda. But there's also blind spots that come with that awareness. So greenhouses meant that there's been perhaps an over-focus on fossil fuels being a bad thing, a primitive form of energy that we need to get past. Whereas what the insights relating to energy peak say is that no, fossil fuels are an incredibly good source of energy that we've wasted, that we've been very wasteful of. And to some extent that's a mutually reinforcing arguments, but in some ways it's also a difference.
Mm.
And so I think that need to recognise the way in which fossil fuels are actually the power that create both the good things and the bad things in society is really important.
You talk about appropriate use of fossil fuels. How do you maintain an integrity within the permaculture movement? And is it possible to use fossil fuels at all without any negative effects?
Well, the example we would give in permaculture's strategies right from the beginning has been quite a strong emphasis on earthworks, using bulldozers to create dams, house sites, appropriately constructed roads, swales and other earthworks to direct the flow of water. Now, this is around the idea that properly designed and constructed earthworks are one of the ancient ways in which people manipulated catchments to increase their total productivity, the rice terraces of Southeast Asia and many other structures that required the work of generations of people working with mostly human labour, sometimes animal power. We now have, as a result of industrial technology and fossil fuels, this capacity to move earth very cheaply. Those earth structures, if they're well designed, can be maintained by future generations with human labour. So that represents a very good investment of the capital capacity we have now with earth-moving equipment and cheap fossil fuels. That is something that we can contribute to future generations. Mm. Now, we can look at that same equipment and same fuel being used to construct, say, another highway for motor cars to go faster on to consume more fuel. Those two uses are both there in the society. If we can direct that earth moving capacity into one, then that's actually a good use of fossil fuel. So that would be perhaps in permaculture strategies would be the most, you know, commonly applied example of that.
Mm-hmm.
What are the main problems with conventional industrial agriculture as you see them?
Well, of course, permaculture started as a critique of industrial forms of agriculture and looking, could we redesign agriculture using natural principles and around an idea that traditional peasant agriculture was labour intensive, industrial agriculture was fossil fuel intensive, and that permaculture was really design and information intensive. The central problem with agriculture, industrial agriculture, is not so much its damage to the productive base, although that is very, very important aspect. The main problem is just that vast amounts of non-renewable energy are used to support an essentially renewable system that provides human food year after year after year. Now, in all pre-industrial societies, agriculture, or its precursors, hunter-gathering, provided a net energy yield. Otherwise, people were dead. And yet, our agriculture system actually consumes more than it produces. Now, that is the fundamental problem with industrial agriculture. As a byproduct of that, it damages the soil and reduces future capacity to produce. Now, there's been a lot of focus on that damage, both with overuse of artificial fertilisers, heavy machinery, monoculture, pesticides, various other things. Now, those things are important, but while they're still a cheap source of energy, it's possible to keep patching the system up, keep using more energy here to compensate for a problem there. When that you get that energy decline, you can't any longer do that, and you fall back on natural pest management. Well, if you've got an environment that has no biodiversity in it, that has no beneficial insects, then you're in the problem that happens when conventional farmers try to convert to organics in a rapid way. They risk going their production crashing. So they need that gradual transition. Similarly, if you look at permaculture focusing on a lot more use of trees and perennial crops because of their energetic efficiency and the fact that you don't need to re-sow them every year, that again requires investment of resources to build up those to the point that they're bearing and productive. And at the moment, that's a problem for farmers due to getting loans from banks and how long it takes to pay off the interest and before the productive return comes in. But it's also a problem of energy. Are there the resources to spend to set up those systems that will take a decade or so to start to yield? So the more extreme forms of industrial agriculture that have developed more in Europe and in the United States under the system of energy, of financial subsidies, is the extreme perversion of agriculture, where you've got like the feedlot, where cows are fed human quality food to produce hamburgers. Now, I think people are very familiar with the environmental and social obscenities that these sort of systems represent, but I think they're perhaps less aware that the extreme energy implausibility of those sort of systems. So just explain that briefly. When I was in Israel looking at these large shed dairies that are like the European dairies where the animals are in sheds, but instead of being fed crops that are grown, at least in Europe, with natural rainfall, the crops in Israel are grown with water, which has been pumped with electricity. Vast field crops of lucerne, of corn, of wheat, then fed to dairy animals. And I said to people there, you know, in Australia, the glass of milk we drink is about 20% oil. In Europe, maybe it's about 50-60% oil. I think the Israeli glass of milk is about 90% oil. And then, of course, in Saudi Arabia, they've gone further than that. They actually desalinate seawater too. So, of course, you know, what that shows is if there's enough energy, you can sort of do anything in a way. You might get some very perverted systems, but it's still possible to do that.
Industrial agriculture leaves behind damaged topsoils and many other negative effects. Can permaculture reverse any of these, and if so, on what scale?
Well, I think there's a positive and there's a negative aspect to that. One of the biggest limiting resources in agricultural productivity is phosphorus around the world. It's critical to plant nutrition, to animal health, and it's in limited supply. And all ecosystems work to maximise to hold phosphorus and recycle it. It's one of the non-renewable mineral resources that humans have dug out of the earth at a few key places around the world in the last 100 years with the aid of fossil fuels, and have spread over large areas of agricultural land. Interestingly enough, it's one of the few elements that doesn't get leached away readily. And it's been estimated that in some parts of Australia's better farmland that's been intensively farmed for potatoes in cool climates, there's enough phosphorus tied up in the soil, locked up, for 100 years of farming, if you could actually make it available. Mm. Now, making it available requires the work of a healthy ecosystem, because nature is actually used to breaking apart this locked up phosphorus in the form of aluminium and iron phosphate. So permaculture systems, especially tree systems, as well as forms of organic agriculture that husband these soil microorganisms, can mine back out some of that resource. So I think that's one of the positive stories, that agriculture hasn't just left a legacy of toxicity and degradation, it's left a legacy of unused abundance. That's been technically difficult to sort of get at, so it's not like people have just pointlessly thrown away fertilisers, but the soil has tied this material up and it requires a more sophisticated soil ecosystem. In terms of really serious toxicities, I think tree-based systems that can actually capture especially the heavy metals and other elemental poisons, which of course can't be broken down or don't go away, can only be tied up, that a lot of those can be tied up in woody structures that aren't food, that soils can be cleaned through going through cycles of, if you like, reforestation. So the land is effectively rested for a phase, taken out of food production. But of course, one of the troubles with this is that as you move into an energy descent world, the pressure to grow more food, because yields per hectare actually drop, so the pressure to bring more land into food production is greater. Mm. While we continue to have some energy and affluence, then growing forests on some of that degraded land is something that to some extent has already happened naturally, in that this in European agriculture, conservation strategies, revegetation, has allowed areas to be taken out of production, ironically because of surplus, too much food being produced. Examples are in Sweden, where they have biomass harvesting, growing short rotation willow coppice crops on agricultural land to actually reduce agricultural surpluses. And then that those crops are fed into district heating plants to provide energy. Now, you can look at that in terms of, is that a system of net energy, and debate that. But it's also a soil healing, cleansing system as well. Mm-hmm. So there's many different ways in which that might work.
So do you envision a labour-intensive form of agriculture if we are to maintain anything like the kind of yields we're getting at the moment?
Well, whether future generations can improve on the agricultural productivity that existed before industrialised agriculture remains to be seen. The expectation that we could actually maintain industrial levels of agricultural productivity, yes, it is possible in intensive gardening to produce more food per hectare than the most intensive industrial systems. But we're looking at mostly garden agriculture where there's a net input of resources of compost materials and very labour intensive. And most of that is actually in urban areas where people live. So we can have garden agriculture, which will actually yield more per hectare than the industrial equivalent form. But with our broadacre agriculture systems, you definitely need many more people, and you need the infrastructure of people able to live on farms. So, of course, all those farm landscapes that there used to be, all these farmhouses that have, of course, all gone now, or relics full of hay or whatever, will again need more accommodation on farms because, yeah, farms will require more people to work them.
I guess one of the most emblematic features of Western society is suburbia. What future do you see for suburbia in an energy-descent world?
Well, I think it's a mixed message. There's tended to be a view that suburban development, spread-out cities, are a product of the motor car, of cheap energy. And although that's true, the suburban landscapes are no denser in human settlement than some of the densest settled intensive agricultural landscapes in the world. Now, admittedly, people living in those modern suburbs consume far more resources in total than people who lived in those densely settled agricultural landscapes. Like somewhere like the Red River Delta in Vietnam, you know, it's higher density of people, you know, just living more or less totally self-sufficient off that land than Australian suburbs. Mm. Now, of course, they're very special environments. They're all fed by integrated water systems, fertile, alluvial, flat land. But similarly, we can look at our suburbs and say they are an infrastructure. They have a water supply system. Our cities are the biggest reticulated agricultural landscapes, if you like, in Australia. So the water is there. We have an infrastructure of hard surfaces that actually harvest storm water, which of course is seen as a problem at the moment, which allows augmentation of natural rainfall to direct that water into the remaining areas that are potentially productive. We've got mostly individual houses that can be retrofitted to have solar access because they're generally far enough set back from neighbouring houses to be able to get that. Now, that might involve cutting down a lot of gum trees and other things in those leafy suburbs. But there's a lot of ways in which the suburbs can be incrementally retrofitted in an energy descent world. And one of the things that I think a lot of the urban planners miss is they assume that any future framework will be driven by public policy and forward planning and design. Whereas I think, given the speed with which we are approaching this energy descent world and the paucity of any serious consideration or planning or even awareness of it, we have to take as part of the equation that the adaptive strategies to it will not happen by some big sensible plan, long-range planning approach, but will happen just organically, incrementally, by people just doing things in response to immediate conditions. So if you live in an apartment in a multi-storey building and you've got to work out how to try and retrofit that in an energy descent context, there's a lot of complex technical infrastructure involved. There's a lot of complex organisation and coordination with the mutual owners or whoever the owners of that building are, and it's very technically complicated. In the suburbs, people can actually just start changing houses and doing things, give or take how they manage the planning regulations and whatever, without the whole of society agreeing on some plan. Mm. And so that, I think, is a really key aspect, that the suburbs are amenable to this organic, incremental, adaptive strategy where someone does something here and then other people learn from that, and where we don't say, yes, we need all of this laid out, the great plan, the roadmap, because I think there is a great danger in, if you look historically, at people who think they've got this great plan for how, you know, it's all going to work, and just be really wary about those people, you know, and whether they're sort of, you know, the great plan for the pure Aryan race or the great plan for many other things. I think we've got to have a lot more faith in incremental organic processes.
Yeah.
In practical terms, you know, what that really means is that big suburban houses that have one or two or three people living in them and mostly not present will actually, people will readapt to live and work from home sort of situation. Say, look, home-based businesses, people take the double garage and dump the cars out, which won't be so useful, and actually set those up as workshops, making things. Backyards, again, will have food production in them. And the street, which is a dead place at the moment in suburbia, will again become an active space because people will be present rather than commuting away all the time. Now, that recreation of active urban life would be not that much different from what existed prior to and even into my childhood in the 1950s. I mean, it's not really a radical thing to envisage suburban life where there's larger households. Now, whether that's a family or whether that's some sort of shared household where people are taking in boarders to sort of help pay the rent or the mortgage or whatever, and help share the tasks that need to be done in a larger, more self-reliant household. Mm. So I'm quite optimistic about how the suburbs can be retrofitted in the energy-descent world.
You talk about how the top-down approach isn't necessarily going to solve our problems. Do you see any problems from entrenched hierarchies stopping the spread of permaculture?
Well, whether these solutions actually spread under a label of permaculture or not is less significant than their spread. But the impediments, I think, are in many different forms. And we can see in the global economy at the moment, there's a lot of the established powers in corporations that are struggling, I believe, at some level to try and position themselves as to how to deal with energy descent. Now, that may not take the form of a corporate plan worked out in the boardroom, but I think somehow there's an understanding in some circles that the current game is a short-lived one. I'd go further and suggest that a lot of the big forces that are driving the world economy and global politics at the moment are very much reflecting energy descent, and that essentially the global war on terrorism, as I think it was Donald Rumsfeld that said, the war that will never end in our lifetimes, is in fact their version of how to deal with energy descent. We'll gather all of the key productive zones under our complete control. So, you know, I think the idea that the society as a whole is completely ignorant of this, I think is wrong. But it may not express itself in the ways we would expect. So that if you look at the drift towards what I'd call sort of fascism that's everywhere in the world at the moment, that seeks to find blame or causes for unfortunate circumstances as being the responsibility of some other group, that is actually a classic response of established authority when it's caught with its pants down, when it's caught, we don't have any plan, no, we are totally negligent, and the response is to say, well, someone else is to blame over here. So, you know, I think whether that emerges as, and whether we describe that as a conscious conspiracy, if you like, or whether we just say this is an organic, natural response to energy descent, I think we're actually seeing that politics now. And that is, I suppose, the biggest threat to the permaculture strategy, with let's just positively engage with energy descent, that this is a new opportunity to learn and to change as we've done in the past.
Could you talk about one of the ideas which I think underlies permaculture, that is Howard Odum's concepts of energy and energy accounting?
Well, certainly one of the very influential influences on permaculture in early years was the work of Howard Odum. And I dedicated my new book, Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, to his memory. He died in 2002. He's an eminent American systems ecologist, and around the world there's a whole network of people who've taken his energy accounting idea, which is called EMERGY, which stands for embodied energy. And it's a particular method of measuring the energy that took to make something, whether it's a built thing or a living thing. Whatever it is, a currency with which we can actually measure the natural and human worlds. And this idea of using energy as a currency for measuring things has got quite a long history, but the various attempts to do it in the past haven't quite worked, partly because people have tried to use just energy itself. And the ways of evaluating the embodied energy in something have been more complicated. So if we look at, as a simple example, we can look at a lump of wood and a book and put both of them in the fire for fuel, and they both have the same amount of calories or joules given off, same amount of energy, but some common sense tells us that that's actually a poor use of a book. So we have in us an energetic common sense which comes from a peasant groundedness connected to nature, which permaculture is trying to recreate because we've mostly lost it, where we actually have this energy hierarchy in our heads of energy quality and embodied energy, because we understand that actually a lot of work one way or another went into making the book. And so as energy descent becomes a public discussion, one of the big issues that emerges is how do you measure this process, this economic process or this social process against that one? Is it worth putting resources into that or this? Now, if we think that the current discussions about public policy priorities and trying to account for environmental, social and economic values are complicated, that's nothing compared with what happens when energy becomes scarcer. Because it then becomes really important that you're actually not wasting resources, putting them into a process which is actually a blind alley. So you need forms of accounting that can compare very, very different things, apples and oranges. And some of the current attempts at environmental accounting, like the triple bottom line, are just an absolute joke. They're sort of an insult to children, even, in terms of their intellectual content, because they try and compare vague abstractions of social and environmental values, just dot-pointed, against a completely econometric financial accounting system of an organisation or body which is actually doing the work. So you've got two hierarchical levels. One is quantitative, trying to compare it with qualitative things, and one is internal to a system, like the accounts of a corporation, for example, and yet most of the environmental and social values that will be listed in triple bottom line accounting will be actually external to the organisation. So it doesn't in any way, it's not add upable. You cannot add it up. So if accounting is not an answer for what to do, but it gives some guidance, because we can look at other systems that we think, well, that's working. How does it stack up by various different ways of accounting? So we can then use these accounting methods as a cross-check on our common sense or our gut feeling about something. And what we find generally is that using energy accounting, generally permaculture strategies come up trumps as the most environmentally progressive strategy. There was a study done some years ago about recycled paper, I think in Britain, and that concluded it was better to just actually put the paper in a energy-efficient furnace wherever the paper was and use it for fuel rather than recycle it. And there's definitely elements of that are true, that are looking at a sort of a whole life cycle process. Ironically, the permaculture strategy of using the paper as a sheet mulch technique to establish a food garden is probably light years ahead of either of those options.
Yep.
So things that look very, very simple, rudimentary, often, if you like, amateur, often when you use these more complete accounting methods, come up as the most energetically efficient. So I think the energy accounting is very technically complex and not many people understand it, but it is something that needs to be understood more if any of this stuff is actually going to get to a level of being adaptive public discussion and public policy. Of course, we may be in an energy descent world where there won't actually be any adaptive public policy, but I suppose most of us would still hope that that common sense does emerge.
Can you talk a little bit about Odum's systems ecology and the type of insights that delivers?
Yeah, well, apart from the energy accounting outcomes of Odum's work, systems ecology, and especially Odum's development of it, provides a big picture, top-down view of systems, whether we're looking at national economy and environment, or whether we're just looking at a region, whatever. It provides a more holistic framework for understanding what's happening in any scale in nature or human society, rather than the reductionist view, which is always trying to pull things apart into their components, study the bits, and then reassemble the functioning system. And that reductionist view that it's has dominated science, and a lot of people believe that that is the only form of science, we've learnt an enormous amount from it, but it's also now got to the point where it's creating more blindness than insight. And that the balance of that, holistic ways of looking at things, of which systems theory is really the greatest example within the scientific tradition, which has had enormously productive outcomes in the form of cybernetics, led to the computer revolution, and yet the thinking behind it is virtually absent in public discussion, in our economy. And Odom's work helps us to try and see how things link together and what are the important flows, the important energy storages, by using an energy circuit language, which can describes things from a farm scale right up to a global scale. And I found that quite useful in understanding the dynamics that work in managing land through to understanding an economy. I think there's a lot of importance in that side of Odom's work as well.
Excellent. Also down to the microbiological scale.
Okay. We can look at systems at any scale. It's not just scales bigger than us. We can look at them at the microbe and yet still take a holistic view of the way an individual organism like a tree, instead of thinking of it as just an organism, we can think of it as a whole lot of productive units, which are the leaves, a whole lot of dead infrastructure, which is all the sort of the heartwood of the tree that holds everything up. We can think of it as a whole habitat for other things. So systems view doesn't necessarily divide things into the convenient compartments that we're used to thinking of. Sometimes it's sort of systems that thread through things. For example, we can think of a forest, of understand it as an interconnection of trees, that all their roots are actually connected together, and that the common shared root system is actually one system, as the canopy is another, rather than thinking, yes, that's one tree over there, another tree there. Similarly, we can think of nutrient flows that the leaves dropping into a stream, contributing nutrients down into the stream. We can think of fish migrating up and being eaten by animals, being eaten by birds, and those nutrients going out into the forest from the stream. So there's many different ways that systems thinking actually connect us also back to indigenous and traditional peasant peoples connected with nature, their ways of understanding things, because they're systems thinking, although it's an incredible abstraction and seems to involve a whole lot of maths and science, is actually brings up insights that are actually more connected to the way indigenous people think.
Given that the global energy peak seems relatively imminent, can you tell us what you think the world might look like in 20 or 30 years?
I probably should say no, because from a systems point of view, we'd say that we're in a change phase which is so multi-level and inherently chaotic. The understandings of chaos theory, systems theory, ideas of ecological change that suggest we're at this big turnover point where things can go many, many different directions all at once. And that what we should expect is that the pattern of the world becoming more globalised, although that still has many outcomes to still continue into the future, some of them perhaps going on for as much as 100 years, the residue of globalisation in all its forms, we can also expect the counterflow of things starting to become localised and differentiated. So we get different outcomes in different places. At the moment, the globalising forces are tending to take the same set of economic solutions, the same set of ideological values, the same set of ways of production, of agriculture, of living everywhere in the world. So there's a uniformity, if you like, a monoculture, wiping out cultural diversity. And of course, this is a great source of angst in the world about loss of local cultural diversity. There's this huge loss of languages going on in the world, which is parallel to the catastrophic loss of biodiversity. But counter to that, as energy descent consolidates, you start to get the forces, the globalised flow of genetic material, plants and animals from all over the world, people from all over the world in a particular place, responding to a particular set of social, economic and environmental and political circumstances, actually developing systems which increasingly are less subject to global buffering or counterflow from elsewhere. So they go their own path. And what that means is we'll have everything from paradise to hell, if you like, in different places. Now those are, of course, extreme judgments, paradise and hell, but I want to suggest that we're actually going to get very, very different outcomes in different places that are not necessarily predictable. You know, to say, oh yes, the conditions here will inevitably lead to this, or and you can see that as, to some extent, the breakdown of the nation state, of the power of the nation state, and local forms of power that might be as diverse as communitarian in one area and feudal through to warlords in another. You know, so I think that's... And the pace at which that emerges, of course, will be very variable. We can see that a lot of those things already exist around the world anyway, and that, of course, we have a very affluent world-centred view about, like, what will the world be like? What we're really saying is, what will the world be like for the billion or so middle-class consumers in the world? Or what will the world be like for the few hundred million Anglo-American middle-class consumers in the world, because they're the ones we can relate to. I suppose a lot of things about the world in 30 years will actually be very, very similar to now. And that's because one effect of energy peak and descent is that you actually get a slowdown in some rates of change. So, for example, building stock, the idea that, well, even 30 years ago, most of the buildings that are currently around were here 30 years ago. People are still living in them. They haven't all been knocked down, and in spite of the rates of development. We can expect in another 30 years that will be even more so, that, yes, we will have knocked down fewer buildings and built new ones. Even energy-efficient buildings, we won't have built all these new buildings. We'll basically be living with the ones we've got. Mm. Similarly, with technology, we'll be making do and adapting things that are no longer being made, that no one can get a profit from making, making new ones. So a lot of that engine of technological change will actually sort of slow down. Now, I think sometimes people assume that engine of technological change has been a straight acceleration even in the last 30 years. But 30 years ago, there were the signs of this energy slowdown. When I was a child, the assumption of everyone was that supersonic air transport was just around the corner, and it was, in the form of the Concorde and the Russian equivalent. The Americans were about to build a supersonic transport which was going to be as big as the Jumbo and had swing wings. It was never built. The Concorde's been taken out of service, has never made a profit. in some ways we've already reached some energy peaks. Mm. Of course, we've seen things like the computer revolution enable all sorts of other ways for that technological engine to keep driving forward. And I think we should expect that the possibility of some of those continuing to accelerate in the next 30 years. Maybe they will, maybe they won't, depending on the state of the world economy, depending on a lot of things which are not to do with actual hard numbers or facts. It's to do with things like faith, that already the world economy may be largely an article of faith, that it's like a thing that's projected out over the precipice by its the collective belief of everyone. So in the 1987 stock market crash, or shortly after it, Ronald Reagan, the most powerful man in the world, said in an amazing sort of naive insight, he said, "There won't be an economic collapse as long as people believe there won't." Extraordinary, really. They're the most powerful person in the world admitting that people could actually bring the whole house of cards down just by losing faith. So, of course, that underlies the inherent unpredictability of things, because it's not when does this resource run out or when is there enough destruction as a result of this to stop that process. It's to do with that people to some extent prefigure what is actually happening through their awareness and their unconscious, and they start to withdraw individually and collectively support for systems. And arguably, I think historians will end up looking back post energy descent, arguing about whether it all could have continued if people had had faith. So there is that possibility of large-scale sudden change because of loss of faith. But it's not inevitable that that happens either. Mm. And that notion of collapse and sort of rebuild can happen at many multiple scales. So what looks like a collapse at one scale, when you step back, is just a slow, adaptive, creative, graceful descent. So if you look at the Roman Empire, the decline of the Roman Empire, it didn't really go in a cataclysmic bang like the Minoan civilization did. It really went in a slow rundown. And to a great extent, a lot of the knowledge and systems of value in the Roman Empire managed to be condensed, repackaged, held on to, because that process of wind down into the what became called the Dark Ages was actually gradual. And so I think there are many, many models, and a lot of it depends on what scale you're looking at, both in time and space.
Do you see any positive outcomes of the energy peak for middle class or high consuming people of the world?
A lot of the limits to affluence that can be best understood are not actually the energetic or external limits. They're the internal limits to affluence, the social limits. Clive Hamilton's book, Growth Fetish, talks about this. Very well, that people are driven mad by the total continuous drive to consume, and the hollowness of this sort of existence, the lack of community, the lack of identity. An energy descent world means that a lot of those destructive and counterproductive behaviours are actually just set aside, because there's more important things to do. So at the extreme, it's a bit like what happens in a society when there's a natural disaster. The community is rediscovered, people set aside their differences and get working on fundamental things. A lot of the angst about alienation and all sorts of intractable problems in society that are seen as very serious at the moment actually almost evaporate. So that is very positive aspect. And for a lot of people, I think it would be an enormous relief that, yes, they haven't been able to get off the treadmill because, you know, peer pressure, individual addiction. Addiction is a really important dynamic, both individually and collectively in society, that people can recognise a problem, want to change, but just can't help themselves. Mm. And they need some crisis or something that affects their peers so they can all change together. And we won't really know how strong that is until you see those effects.
What do you think about the die-off scenarios like those proposed by Jay Hansen in his website dieoff.org?
I've followed a bit some of the in the late 90s, looked at some of the emerging discussions on the internet. Jay Hansen's was one of them. I mean, I think the die-off scenario and that sort of really provocative wake-up call, I think, is actually really useful, and I think it can't be completely discounted in the sense of large and very catastrophic drop in populations, sort of like bigger versions of what happened in Europe with the Black Death. And, you know, you'd have to say the most likely causal agent is infectious diseases. And, of course, there's a lot of evidence about the re-emergence of infectious diseases, both old ones and new ones. So these possibilities are definitely there, but I think they get confabulated, all joined together with things like just a decline in material affluence back to the levels of what existed in the 1930s would be seen by many people as the die-off scenario. So in that sense, I think it's, yes, people should really expect radical changes, and a lot of things that are taken for granted now might sort of disappear and evaporate. And that could also be in the same way that in the third world now, you could say, okay, well, AIDS in Africa is a die-off scenario. But if you actually step back and look at past phases of big disasters, global wars, even the 1919 influenza epidemic that ravaged world population, those things on the bigger scale are relatively small hiccups, and I don't think of them as being really the die-off scenario. The die-off scenario, seriously, is actually really the whole end to the development of intensive settled agriculture, civilization, and then industrialization on top of that, that actually all of that of the last 6,000 years effectively goes into the dustbin of history. Mm. And that what goes with that is a very large drop in human population over a relatively short time, like 100 years, possibly back to some sort of hunter-gatherer type organisation with a much depleted resource level and without the capacity to use the resources that we would use if we still had the sort of systems in place. So, and you get a complete regrowth of wild nature over the planet, and you get that cycle starting again, but without the possibility of it going to the fossil fuels stage. Even that, I don't think, is the end of the human story. You know, so, but given that fossil fuels represent hundreds of millions of years of stored energy. They're effectively the surplus of the abundance of Gaia as a self-organizing organism, the living Earth. That the fossil fuels are the surplus that she put away in the piggy bank over the last few hundred million years of terrestrial abundance, because most of it's come out of terrestrial, the small area of the world that's not covered in oceans, that's covered in land, that at various times has been enormously biologically productive and has just produced this huge surplus of organic matter that's been put away in the piggy bank. And we've dug it all out again, and you could say that we've actually done nature's task, and that, okay, even that is actually that humanity's task is over. We've put it all back into the atmosphere, we've recirculated all the biological elements, the world's stirred everything up again, and that nature will actually use that to now develop to a higher level of energy, and humans will just be swept away in that. So it is possible, and I'm not being fanciful here, that if you actually look at how big fossil fuels is the Earth's storage of energy, we are talking about a dynamic which is geologic in scale. Mm. It's actually even bigger than the ice ages. So it's silly to discount the possibility that any order of change that humans have ever experienced before, including the ice age, is smaller than what we're now involved in.